I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. When Scott Shepherd was a fifth grader, his history teachers broke the students into two teams, the Confederate soldiers and the Union soldiers, to study the Civil War, slavery, to battle each other and earn points. One unit involved a game sneaking around the school and stuffing black dolls into different boxes called safe houses. Well, that lesson stayed with Scott and became the inspiration for Underground Railroad game that had its premiere at the Philadelphia Fringe Festival. He and Jennifer Kidwell, who wrote an act in the play that turns the audience into a fifth grade class. They are two middle school teachers and explore reenactment culture, race relations, bodies, sex, violence, the N-word, and more. Underground Railroad play is at the Christchurch Neighborhood House, 20 North American Street near 2nd and Market, and it runs through September 12th. And they join us on Radio Times to talk about the Underground Railroad game. And Jen Kidwell, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
And also with us is Scott Shepherd, and nice to have you with us as well.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going very well. So take us back to your fifth grade class. This was a real, what, a lesson in the history of the Civil War.
Yeah, right. So in my fifth grade class, we had this unit. It was the Civil War unit. And because we live in Hanover, which is only a few miles east of Gettysburg, there's a big reenactment culture, a lot of Civil War buffs, and they are they romanticize the Civil War a lot. And so we had a group of fifth grade teachers that were very excited about teaching us everything they knew. So we had this interactive unit where we were split into Confederates and Union soldiers, and we competed, you know, doing different school activities to accrue points for our different teams. So like the spelling bee, Civil War songs, marching competitions, you could earn points by doing these different activities. And then at the end of the war, you would win or lose the war. And that was how you kind of learned about the Civil War.
Well, reaffirm or rewrite history.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And so one of the games was the Underground Railroad game. And so in this game, we had boxes labeled safe house, and the Union soldiers had to sneak the slaves from box to box. And the teachers would kind of mark their progress, and you could earn points by, you know, marching them towards Canada, which was the last box. And the Confederate soldiers had to capture these slaves. So if they were, you know, out and about, if they were visible, if they weren't in a safe house, the Confederate students could capture them and go to get a police officer, which were the teachers. Right. And then the dolls were put in a display case, which was jail.
And in your fifth grade history class, who won that war? Was it the North or the South?
My year was the Union, but it depends. It goes both ways. It just depends. They don't do the game anymore, but they did it for a while. And they, you know, I think about 7 years ago was the last time they did the unit.
And why did this stay with you?
At the time, it was one of the most fun moments in school. I mean, it was this live action role-playing game. And we were, you know, coming up with all these schemes. We were putting slaves in our, you know, backpacks and sneaking around. And that was, like, really fun. But in retrospect, obviously, there's just it's so complicated. And it just makes you think about all of the different ways in which we, you know, continue to objectify the black body, or the ways in which we tell stories. You know, history is still written by a certain group of people, you know, the people with the power and the people who with the privilege.
So I'm curious, Jen, I'm assuming that Scott came to you and said, look, there was this crazy thing that happened in fifth grade, and perhaps we could turn this into something for the Philadelphia Fringe Festival? Or some version of that, maybe?
Yeah. We were just hanging out one night with some friends, and he told this story. And it was, like, pretty late, you know. And he tells this story, and I was just like, what happened? And I was cracking up. I was like, that is the craziest thing I've ever heard. I thought one of the craziest things I've ever heard in my entire life. Just bizarre. And I went to a school. I mean, I was schooled in Baltimore, and I went to school with a lot of Civil War buffs. And, you know, there was a lot of, like, a deep commitment to, you know, like, the struggle and complexities. But we didn't play this game.
Yeah.
And, yeah. So, actually, Scott was going to make a solo piece originally. And then Scott and I had been assigned... We were to be assigned a duet. So we went to school together at the Pig Iron School at APT. And we were supposed to create a duet in our dance class. And but I had to miss some school, so we missed that assignment. And so Scott said, well, instead of... And I said, can we do the assignment and we make it up? And he was like, well, instead of making the dance, we tried to make a dance and it was pretty bad.
There's a little dancing in this.
Yeah. That's about as much dancing as Scott and I should be doing together, I think. But he had a, the better idea.
I thought it was beautiful.
Yeah. It was beautifully... It's like, it wasn't good. He had the better idea of creating this piece, and I was like, "Yeah, let's do that."
A piece which I saw on Friday night, something like this. So how does that start when you start to put something together? I mean, obviously this is based on an experience you had in fifth grade, and then it gets turned into something that people then come to see. Is it a matter of kind of role playing of kind of free associating as you put this together?
Yeah, but I think that things really started coming together. So we actually went to, I don't know if we're going to get in trouble for saying this on the radio, but we went to this talk at the National Portrait Gallery here in Philly.
Yeah.
And there was a park ranger there who was giving a talk about slavery. And it was such a bizarre day. It was like, it was a weekday. It was rainy.
It was a white guy.
He was a white man. It was a rainy weekday. And there were about seven people listening to this talk about the Underground Railroad at the National Portrait Gallery. This is like one of these things that, like, you know, the Park Service will do that tend to be underattended. And he was clearly very knowledgeable about the subject, but it was so awkward. He was having so much trouble talking, just finding the language around slavery.
Yeah.
You know, like, he was like, I don't know. He couldn't say
like
black people or African American. He was
he said all of them.
Yeah, it was like
the formerly enslaved people
who were
looking for the correct language.
And it was every time he's given a talk about the Underground Railroad, you know, that word is going to come up a lot, and every time it was a problem for him. And he's like contending with all of these historical facts that he's trying, he seems to care a lot about, but then the awkwardness of how to say. And one of my favorite moments was when he was like, and, you know, and slavery is bad. I mean, it was just, terrible, really, really terrible. And you know, you're like listening to somebody talk and like kind of feeling empathetic about like how difficult it is, and it is difficult and it is complex, but at the same time you're like, honey, it's a lot hard. Slavery is a lot harder than you talking about it, so spit it out.
Just,
you know,
say it.
Like, what do you mean? It's like he's having so much trouble, and I'm like, dude, nobody's making you work for free. You're getting paid for this, so like, let's keep it moving. But Scott and I had a pretty good time at that talk. And
we thought, this is something we can use as
like this is the entryway. We were rehearsing and we were doing an improv for two of our other former classmates, and things weren't totally clicking, but then we sort of turned out to them and sort of adopted the role of the awkward park ranger, and that was really fun.
Right. Because, you know, as a teacher or a park ranger, anybody who's supposed to educate other people, there's just a way of presenting information. And when you contrast that performance style with a subject matter that is really contentious, it's just very ripe for complexity and humor in this case, because they are trying to mask the very thing that they are actually showing so clearly.
Yeah.
Well, what I thought, and as I said, the audience is this fifth grade class. But both of you have the kind of teacher voices. I mean, the ways of addressing the class, either with kind of intention and enthusiasm and focus and a smile. I'm looking at you, Jen.
Well, because Scott's got like a natural teacher presence. Like, everybody together, we all want to do this together. He's got an amazing facility with that. I think, I'm a little less. We're both former teachers, actually.
Oh, you mm-hmm. are?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I used to teach adults. And
I used to teach at Friends Central School out on the main line.
So you know how to, that teacher voice.
Yep.
It's natural.
It comes natural.
I taught in high school, though. So I had, middle school is a very specific kind of, forgive me for saying this, middle school teachers, but there's a specific kind of saccharine, powerful, energetic camp counselor vibe that you have to really tap
trying to
into.
Cut through all those hormones. Just to,
that's right.
It's not easy.
More power to you. Yeah, it's seriously. A difficult.
Well, early on, you ask all the audience, you tell the audience, look under your chair. You're either going to be, on the Union side or on the Confederacy side. And I was thinking,
what side were you on?
Well, I was actually on the Union side.
Okay. Yeah, go blue.
As was my
good
husband. But I thought maybe they're keys to a new car under my chair.
It's our Oprah moment.
Your Oprah moment. That somehow there would be something like that.
Something that wasn't just
just a toy
soldier. A penny's, like a very cheap plastic toy. Yeah.
Keepsake.
And from the audience point of view, I mean, there is an audience participation, which always mm-hmm. scares me a lot because I just feels like to be pulled onto a stage and do something. But, I mean, clearly you are working off and playing with an audience that is both kind of horrified, but also laughing, mm-hmm. sometimes a little shocked as well.
Did you feel okay in the audience? Did you feel like
I did feel okay?
We took care of you, or
yes,
or kind of.
I did. As I said, I think when you're hauled on stage, it's very uncomfortable.
Yeah, we tried that in some earlier.
Oh, did you?
We did.
Yes.
When you make theater the way we make it, 99% of the material we make is on the cutting room floor. We've tried lots of different things, and so. Some of the best stories are never going to be shown. That,
yeah.
Thank God.
Yeah, maybe they shouldn't be shown.
We're almost up in a break here, but I know you did some stories for WHYY about what it was to work together, and it sounds mm-hmm. like Jen, there was a fair amount of, can we say, arguing or disagreement or conflict over between you and Scott putting this together.
Yeah, Scott. I mean, I think Scott and I make work, like the work is born out of a disagreement. So we've haggled over every word, every, like, even like fold of cloth. Like, I think those pants need to be a little, like, they need to be like a
everything
little
matters though.
Yeah, yeah. And everything is if you gave Scott and I a quiz and had a separate take it separately, there would be the opposite answers on everyone. It's kind of amazing. But I think that's
great.
What makes the work strong, because we've had to fight for everything.
Well, I do want to pick up on that. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Jennifer Kidwell, and also with us, Scott Shepherd. And their Underground Railroad game is at the Christchurch Neighborhood House, part of the Philadelphia Fringe Festival, runs through September 12th. And joining us on Radio Times to talk about how they put this together, we're going to have them do a quick reading from the play as well. And do stay with us. We will be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Jen Kidwell and Scott Shepherd about their Underground Railroad game, one of the many productions being presented at venues across the city, part of the Philadelphia Fringe Festival. The festival runs through the 19th. Their play runs through September 12th. Apparently it's been sold out, but they just added another production or another presentation, and September 12th at 9:30.
Ooh, the 11th.
It's
Friday the 11th. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Yeah. Yes.
Added show at 9:30.
Very good. We want to have that be correct. You can also join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Right before the break, you were talking about the fact that there was a lot of disagreement. I mean, even how things were folded and how wrinkly things were. But is that part of the creative process that works for the two of you?
Yeah,
to
absolutely.
To kind of fight things out?
Yeah, we love to argue. So that's the way we get things done.
Yeah.
The creative friction.
we also work really differently. Like, Scott's really good at looking at the entirety of the piece and how things should logically move. I mean, I think it's fair to say that you approach things like very logically. which is really helpful because I don't.
You don't.
Yeah, I don't really have an eye on logic.
Jen thinks very visually. I mean, Jen thinks like a visual artist in a lot of different ways. She, you know, reaches for these poetic moments. And, you know, what's really fun is Jen will come into the rehearsal room and say, I want to see this. I don't know how we get there. I don't know where we go from there, but I want to see this.
Like what? What's a this?
One of the so many things. One of the big visions that we ended up sharing was the scene with the woman on the box, and we had done that scene. That scene actually has changed over time. Mm-hmm. So when we first did the scene, I was actually in silhouette.
It was based off of Kara Walker's work.
Oh. Yeah. I was in silhouette, and so couldn't have a relationship to the audience, but the scene kind of unfolded in the same way. And then when we did the show at Ars Nova in New York, we weren't able to create that silhouette effect. So we had to make a decision, like, how is this going to work if the audience actually sees me? And then it changed because then I got to play with the audience, and it actually made the scene a lot stronger. And then I was like, but it's not... We have to really like share the absurdity of this, because the scene kind of kicks off with Scott saying that we have brought in a real slave into an assembly for these students.
It no longer had that like iconographic element that it used to have with the silhouette.
Yeah, it's not iconographic. Now it's like pushing more into the absurd, and I think that the absurdity is introduced by we have reached into history and like we are sharing with you an actual slave, which is sort of a nod to all of these like reenactment movements
and she's like kind of a seductress on top of it.
Yeah.
That scene's based off of a trope that we've really tried to dismantle, which is this magical Negro trope. This is something that Jen and I talk a lot about and look for in American culture. Yeah. But
what does that mean, magical Negro?
It was a term coined, I think, by Spike Lee about the black person who appears in movies or books, who's like all-seeing, all-knowing, very wise, deep-voiced, earthly, with
sassy, no past
and no future. Sassy, but really just appears to help the white protagonist, like, you know, overcome all odds. So,
Legend of Bagger Vance. Legend of Bagger Vance is one of the purest versions of this.
But also like Mary Alice in The Matrix.
Green Mile. Let's not forget.
Green Mile. Oof.
Let's not forget the gems.
Yeah. there's so many. Some comedian said... I'm like going to totally bastardize this quote, but they're like, Morgan Freeman in just about anything.
I was thinking, actually, Morgan Freeman as you were describing.
Much respect, though.
Much respect. Total respect, but also, can he get a storyline?
Well, there is, and I have to say, in part of this play, I mean, you two were teachers. There's clearly some kind of chemistry between the two of you. We see you holding hands and kind of arguing, but also a lot of kissing, dancing, some chemistry there. But it also plays on these racial ideas about interracial relationships and who expects what from whom, and how do, you know, even if you're in love, do you sort of still see that person as some form of a stereotype? Is that kind of what you were going for?
Yeah, I think it's that. I think it's also a play about play in a way that, like, I don't know if we're like reaching through to get to like a nugget of truth, or really just trying to like expose the ways that we tell ourselves that we're supposed to navigate this terrain.
Yeah, one of the things we play with in the show is just rules. I mean, the rules that we're supposed to follow, and what happens when you break the rules in public and in private, and what's the difference, and why is there a difference, and how do you have to censor yourself? What do you have permission to do?
Yeah. And there are, I think that's these parameters.
I did pull out a little section from the play.
Uh-oh.
They're both eyeing the script with a great deal of trepidation here.
Yeah.
Because
I haven't seen this in weeks.
I know, exactly. Trepidation and also like, what is this?
But it is about, again, this relationship, but also the sort of hostility that's sort of built into the flirtiness, if I can put it that way. But I'd love to have you just do a little back and forth for our listeners.
When I was in college, you know, all my friends had this we had this secret competition to see who could sleep with more women from different countries, you know, like different ethnicities. I'm winning.
I love how confident you are.
I love how defiant you are.
I love how shameless you are.
Right back at you, sister.
Can you do this thing for me? I know the world's always putting all this pressure on you, you know, saying you have all the money and you have all the power. But with me, could you just be yourself?
You smell great. Can I smell you? Now that is comfort.
Your hair is so angelic, the way the light hits it. You look like a little pink cherub.
What happens when your hair gets wet? Does water just, like, fall off of it?
I wonder what you're going to be like in the dark. Like, are you going to be my own personal nightlight?
I hear what you're saying, but sometimes it's hard to follow because all I see is just teeth, teeth, teeth.
Because of the contrast. You know, most of the time with white men, I can feel their sphincters just clench up with this fear that if they're not careful, they're going to slip right back into history and start ordering me around, you know, trying to make me clean their house. Not you.
Oh, no, I can imagine you cleaning my house.
Yeah?
Yeah. Or no, better yet, churning butter. Those ample skirts.
And that's a scene from Underground. I'm stopping you right there. No. Okay. I'm stopping you right there. That's a scene from Underground Railroad Game. Yes, indeed. And Scott Shepherd and Jennifer Kidwell, our guests in this hour of Radio Times, they wrote Underground Railroad Game, performing in it as well. And they have been performing in and around Philadelphia for a number of years now. In fact, I saw Jennifer last year. I saw both of you last year in another production, part of the Philadelphia Fringe Festival. Their play runs through September 11th. They just added a 9:30 show for that night. And the Fringe Festival runs through September 19th here in Philadelphia. And to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes, whyy.org, and you can tweet us at whyy Radio Times. I love this. I mean, it was fun to watch you perform this up close. You're right across the table from me. But just to watch the kind of the beats, the rhythms, the slight pauses, the, you know, those little momentary sort of moments of tension.
It's feels ingrained, actually. It's like kind of ingrained. Yeah. Sometimes we think about this scene, or I think about this scene as like a stand-up. And I think this kind of got kicked off by this question of hipster racism, like the things that people who, quote, know better, end quote, are allow themselves to say. And it's funny because I think a lot of people respond to the scene and they're like, I just can't believe what he's saying to you. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I hear this on the street. Like, people, we actually had, should we tell the story about the woman on the street? God. We can never remember what she said, but Scott and I were walking down the street near City Hall not too long ago. And we like got out of the train and this woman, a black woman walked up to us and she was selling candy and she approached me about the candy, right. I think, first. She's like, do you want some, you want to buy some candy? And I was like, no, I'm good. And then she looked at him and she was like, is this your man? And I was like, no. And she goes, oh, yeah. And she said something like, I wouldn't mind spreading cheese on that cracker or something like that.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. But, you know, yeah, these things are afloat. And, you know, I've heard like all kinds of crazy things.
Philadelphia supplies our script.
Is that true?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of what you've heard on the street in Philly.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
And I mean, I think it's important to know the scene that we just read really does, it comes out of a really meet cute, fun, kind of sweet, romantic scene. And that, and there's a kind of a click and it turns. And so you thought you were in one play and then now you're in another. And we're really kind of playing with those assumptions, the, you know, the idea that, oh, everything's okay, and yeah. we're having so much fun, and they're figuring it out.
Yeah, and I think the implicit rules for that kind of scene, that, like, there's a safety in the Hollywood product of a meet cute, and, you know, like, what romance is supposed to look like. And those rules are actually very strict. So, you know, our question was, well, what if we try to, like, superimpose this idea of hipster racism where, you know, I'm staring the rules down and you know, making my own with a format that's, like, so formulaic and so recognizable. And what happens if they clash?
Mm. Mm-hmm. Mm.
And some people describe that scene as a kind of like a dive into the unconscious or the subconscious of those characters, the things that never get said, just the, like, fleeting thoughts. What if we took those fleeting thoughts and kind of purified them and intensified them and took a look at them under a microscope?
Mm-hmm. So, like that Annie Hall scene when they're talking back and forth.
Yes,
and
yes,
what
yes.
they don't, what they're thinking, but they don't say.
Yeah.
Oh, so
yeah.
good, yeah.
Because there's so much, I think, at the beginning of the scene. Like, one of my favorite things is when we do the scene, and sometimes people will be like, oh, like right. hearing people, like, really, really into, like, this is so sweet and cute.
It's a scene where we mentioned Sandra Bullock, so.
Immediately it's sweet and cute.
Right. They're like, oh, that's the cue.
Yeah.
That's the cue for me.
I know what scene I'm in. Sandra Bullock was mentioned.
Yeah. And then by the end of the scene, it's, you know, like, all of those ahs have fallen away and there's just, like,
we rip Sandra Bullock apart.
Well, even more,
like,
than that.
Gasps,
I mean, yeah.
in silence, like, yeah. I can't.
And our audience is different for different nights, or can you kind of consistently rely on they're going to do this here, they're going to do that there?
Well, they have different flavor. I feel like there's, like, the audience theme for the night. Like, we really like the love story, or, like, we really like all the bad stuff you do, or we just want to laugh, or, like, this isn't funny.
Love those.
All
audience.
Of the above, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is different, you know, because this play really jerks people around, and you know, part of the rules of this play is that we try to stay one step ahead of the audience at every moment, so they never quite know where they are and what they're watching. And so for some people, there's no permission to laugh if that is if those are the rules. And for other people, that's the exact situation where laughter occurs,
can cause release. Yeah, I think something that comes up a lot with this piece is people want to be reassured about our point of view, and that they really want to be able to track our perspective on these things to make sure that they're safe.
Right.
And I think
it's this idea of, like, please, please tell me that the makers know what they're doing.
Yeah, please tell me you know what you're doing. And I'm like,
it is the fringe, though, right?
Yeah, maybe we don't.
We might be crazy.
Yeah, I mean, like, wow, we can't know any better than anybody else, and, like, clearly nobody else knows what's going on.
Well, there is a scene. I mean, it's called, the name of the scene is, or the part is sex detention. But it's like the slave market, right? Although, I mean, you're the sort of dominatrix. You're the sort of kept man, I guess, in this situation. You're naked,
the
Scott.
Sub.
The sub.
The sub. You're naked, and she's measuring you, and she's looking at your arms and your body parts and trying to sort of figure out what kind of a specimen you are. And it's uncomfortable. On several different levels. Are you comfortable being naked in front of an audience, Scott?
That was Scott's idea.
Okay.
No, that's like one of my favorite. That's like one of my favorite things. When Scott proposed this on the phone, and I was like, "Yes, yes."
For himself.
Yeah. It's like brilliant.
We used to do the scene where I didn't get naked, but then, so it was this whole conversation because she's naked in the piece as well.
That's right.
And we had this long discussion about, you know, equity and is it fair to have a piece where, you know. In this kind of very weird and wild way, her body is displayed and really is on display in that moment. And it's really complex. Is it being objectified, or is it being honored, or is it being, you know, are both things happening at the same time? And once that was in the room, then, you know, I remember Jack Tambori, one of our assistant directors, and Sarah Sanford, our director, both are amazing, were, you know, saying, we think you have to get naked too. You know, it now, and that was the scene where it could have happened. We all knew that that was kind of a direction we could have gone. And so tipping it towards this idea of the slave auction block just kind of was a mashup.
The objectified body.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Were you come to, I mean, well, you both are naked in this. Mm-hmm. Are you, come, does it, is this like a, oh my gosh, I have to go out and be naked?
No,
or is it
just
part
fine.
Of acting?
I've,
Scott.
I've been
Scott
naked in
shows. Been naked in
I've been naked in shows before.
This is not a first for him.
Yeah. No. No.
It's, yeah.
But, I, but you
but
know,
not
it's
naked.
Not
We're not naked in every show either.
Well, I'm not.
Yeah.
You're more naked than I am. But I mean, my nudity was my idea too. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was, it was like part of trying to fix that scene when we couldn't do the silhouette. It was like something has to happen. Like, how do we take this a little,
but you know what,
further?
In making theater, it's something it really has to be earned. You know, mm-hmm. The thing we're working towards is should not require nudity unless that moment is really mm-hmm. like earned. And in this case, you know, as much as we were hesitant and careful, it just seemed in the end that it was a place we needed to go.
Yeah,
just
I think it's important.
The subject matter, I mean.
It's about bodies, right?
It was about mm-hmm. bodies. It's about
and,
bodies.
And about, like, bodies on display and, like, who's watching at what mm-hmm. time.
Who has ownership over these bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation, talking with Jennifer Kidwell and Scott Shepherd and their Underground Railroad game, part of the Philadelphia Fringe Festival. The festival runs through September 19th. Their play runs through September 11th. It's at Christ Church Neighborhood House near 2nd and Market Streets. And we are talking about some of the ideas, some of the thinking that has gone into Underground Railroad game. We'll be talking a bit more about their acting together, what they're doing in the future. And again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Jennifer Kidwell and Scott Shepherd about Underground Railroad Game. Their show, part of the Philadelphia Fringe Festival, explores things like race relations, slavery, middle school, the N-word. It is funny, I have to tell you. It may not sound funny on paper. And joining us in this hour of Radio Times, and again, you can join the conversation, 1-888-477-9499. Part of this is the N-word. And you know, I have such trouble with saying the N-word, saying what the word actually is. It is such a fraught word, but an important part of this play.
Yeah.
And how it's used.
Yeah. And I think the greater question about language, too. Language, I mean, I think you really hit the nail on the head when you said about the rules, mm-hmm. Scott. And I think there are rules for language. There are rules about who can say what. Yeah. When another inspiration for this show is the animated series, The Boondocks. Mm. And there's this great episode about the N-word in which a young man, Riley, one of the main characters, who's probably about seven mm-hmm. or so, maybe he's a little bit older, he says the N-word. And then his teacher repeated it. His white teacher repeated it. And he was like, but I was just saying what he was saying. And, you know, it's fantastic. And it's really like a great question mm-hmm. about like who has permission to do what, why? When, and how. And
we get into that territory almost, you know, the same exact territory. But when is it in quotes? When,
right.
You know, when
right.
when do I have, when am I allowed to say it because I'm saying it for the right reasons?
Yeah.
So the
were
play.
Were you being told to say it?
Right. And, mm-hmm. and the play proposes this idea that a kid in the school graffitis a sign by writing that word on one of the signs.
And a derivation of that word, derivation.
Right.
Or,
derivation.
I don't know, like, yeah.
Yeah. And so we have an assembly scene where we present the students with the graffitied object, and then we have a conversation. We call that scene community action. Right? It's that scene where it's kind of like, well, if no one's going to say who wrote this, then everyone wrote this.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we're a community. And so we're as, you know,
We're guilty. All implicated.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. We're all implicated. So we gave birth to this as a community. So as a community, we need to heal this. So there's this kind of discussion, this, you know, at times Quakerly, at times absurd discussion about what needs to be done to heal this group of people. But along the way, you know, there's this there are all sorts of crazy things that happen. I mean, this guy, the character that I play, is so self-concerned and is so narcissistic. And so even, you know, his martyrdom is just coded in, like, self-loving.
Mm. I think both of the teachers are like that. And
that's true.
I think that that's a – I mean, that's like a question maybe we have about pedagogy. Like, how does it work? How do you give knowledge to somebody else in a way that's like – that actually is generous and model behavior in a generous way? When we're all people, we're all flawed, like nobody's perfect, don't know everything. So how do we negotiate the things we know with the things we don't know? And what are the rules for the information that gets shared with certain people, what's appropriate for certain people? And I think that scene is interesting because there's all these questions about what's appropriate. Scott's character actually says the N-word that scene, but in a way that's too, you know, but he's like accusing.
To edify.
Yeah, to edify. That's his action. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a moment in which, like, I'm holding the defaced sign and I say, we have been hurt by this, which, you know, on one level is part of the fiction of the scene, but also is true. Like, we have been hurt by this. So how are we receiving these hurts? Mm-hmm. And then Scott's character really transgresses the rules by the end of the scene.
Yeah. I mean, it opens up all these really interesting conversations about teaching, too. I mean, you're teaching fifth grade students, right? So, you know, you're faced with this conundrum. In order to impart knowledge that they're going to remember, you have to make it digestible. You have to make it simple. And that very simplicity is also offensive. Yeah. And that's not how things went. And so
a pitfall. It's confusing for people.
It's very confusing. It's a tricky line to walk. I mean, you know, when you're in fifth grade, it's this like trouble with legacy or how we remember things. They're easier to remember if the legacy is simple, if it's clear, if it has a kind of, you know, thematic thrust. But things aren't like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's complicated.
Yeah.
What were you like in fifth grade, Jen?
I spent a lot of my fifth grade in the orchestra room. I grew up playing the violin. And I used to, like, try to get all my work done. And then I'd be like, oh, I have to, like, go help. Mr. Whitman was our conductor. So I was like fixing instruments. It was like putting glue on like fingerboards for string instruments. And like I did this thing where I would bring instruments home. I couldn't play any of them, but I would like bring them home. Like every week I had a different instrument. I remember like playing the trumpet in my neighborhood and the neighbors were like, you have to make her stop.
Like a quieter instrument. Right?
Yeah, quieter. Yeah. So
you were a good student though. Obviously if you could get your work done.
I was a good student. Like I got my work done.
Yeah.
And you know, like it went pretty well for me, but like was I a good student? Uh-huh. No. I mean, I'm a bad student. I'm like here. Here's what you asked for. I don't want to listen to you anymore.
I'm going to go to Mr. Whitman's room.
I'm going to go to Mr. Whitman's room. You can't stop me. I already did my work. Leave me alone.
And how about for you, Scott? What kind of fifth grader were you?
I was obedient and careful.
Were you?
I kind of was. No, I think I was. I was like, when we did this game, I was a captain. Like, I worked really hard to become a captain.
What's a captain? Corporal, in the army.
Right.
Yeah.
It was an elevated status. I don't know.
I would have wanted to do that.
I was trying really hard to please people in fifth grade.
Were you a good student? And by that, I mean, I guess, getting good grades.
Sure.
As you said,
I think so. I was certainly trying really hard to get good grades.
I tried to get good grades, too, but I just wanted to do it my way.
And when did you start acting? Or when did you become interested in theater or performance?
In fourth grade, I got to play Mrs. Cratchit in A Christmas Carol.
Oh.
And that was very fun.
I wish I could.
Was that your
that.
First? Yeah, that must have been great.
I think that was my first role. There was something else. There was like a Robin Hood or something. I think that also. I had a contentious relationship with a fourth grade teacher, Dr. Berkeley. I can't just say this woman's name. Whatever. Her name was Dr. Berkeley, and we did not have a good relationship. Because she,
for the
record, like kind of, according, my mom will say this, like she played favorites. She didn't like that you were a good student, and she like had a lot of problems with you. And I just remember having problems with her, and just like anything she wanted me to do, I'd just be like, no, I'm not going to do that. And so I remember I think we were supposed to be doing like a reading of Robin Hood. And she was like, no, say the text like this. And I was like, no. I think there was like rhyming. Wow. And I one day tried to turn it into a rap or something like that. It was like,
no.
Not welcome. But yeah, that's when it started. But for a long time, I wanted to be a lawyer.
Oh, wow. Which is a form of theater in a way.
I think there's a lot of crossover between litigators and actors.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, lots of memorizing too, I guess you have to do as well.
Memorizing and definitely love of your own voice. And I think that I finally accepted like, oh, you don't really want to be a litigator. What you want to do is listen to yourself all the time. So you should just
But that makes sense. You like to parse problems and, you know, figure things out on a language level.
And when you mean voice, you mean your actual voice or just the voice to say what you want to say?
All of the above.
And how about for you, Scott? I mean, early on. Did you want
acting?
To be an actor?
No, I didn't.
I mean, you were a teacher for a while.
I was a teacher
Scott's
for a while.
Scott's also an amazing writer.
I did love to write. I've always loved to write. I was really into sports when I was in school.
That's right. Basketball.
I played basketball. I was obsessed with
that's
playing
part
basketball.
Of the true story.
And yeah, I did. I always loved writing. I always loved reading and writing. My English teachers were my favorites, with a few exceptions too. But
and how did you get in? So you taught for a while.
How did you get into theater? I don't know.
In college, right?
I guess in college I performed a little bit and really liked it. Didn't know that it was going to take over my life. I was a teacher for a while. I had a very stable, nice life.
Grown-up life.
You threw it out the window.
And then I decided to shatter it for some absurd reason. No, I was really inspired by a lot of the makers in town, and Philadelphia is just such a great place. So many inspiring individuals. And
supportive.
You know, and supportive. And Pig Iron Theater Company, I mean, they made amazing shows, and I really loved watching them. And then when they, you know, introduced the idea of a master's program, quote unquote, it's a
now it is
that's right, MFA, you know, the school, I looked into it and was really interested, so I decided to leave my job and go back to school.
It is a really good theater town. I have to say, we have the best team of people.
Yes,
helping us with this show. The best. And they're like, they've been so good. We've just kind of gone up to people and been like, hey, we want to make this thing. Will you help us?
Wow.
And they've been like, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
So
in terms of sound design, which
sound
is
design,
very much
Alex Bechtel, who's one of our classmates,
right.
Our director, Sarah Sanford, who was our teacher, assistant director, Jack Tambori, who I got to work with. I've worked with a couple of times.
Una Curley.
Lighting designer par excellence.
She's
Catherine
awesome.
Fritz's costumes. Our stage manager.
Annie
our
Holiday.
Assistant stage manager, Petra, who came in at the last minute.
It's a great team.
Steven, our scenic designer, is like in LA working on a show right now. I mean, everybody's doing other things, but they like eked out time for us.
Now, will you continue to perform this, or is at some point is this done? Will you take it to other fringe festivals?
I don't think it's done. I was thinking about that this morning. I think we have a lot
of tweaking
to do.
Where you can still tweaking and fine-tuning and changing.
I definitely want to tweak. The audience teaches you so much about the show, and so now we're really starting to get a sense of it. Now that it's finished, we really are starting to get a sense of what needs to be modified. And
I'm trying to take Scott's like bird's eye view and look at the whole thing now.
It's a really tricky thing. When you're moment-to-moment work is one thing, and when you're in a scene, the rhythms and the way that they feel, and it's really, really difficult, especially when you're, you know, deep into a piece,
mm-hmm.
to know how it's working on people on this kind of macro level.
And how to step back from it and look at it more objectively, I guess.
Yeah, it's kind of impossible, but...
We know the piece so well, it's really hard to occupy that place of a new viewer. You know, what's really working and how is it working on a, you know, visceral level and on an intellectual level? We're really working hard to make the writing kind of smart, and we're also working to make the experience unique and interesting.
What do you do after a show? Are there certain things you do that just, you know, once the show is done, is there...
You mean after the run or just like night to night?
Night to night.
I tend to need a little sip of whiskey.
There's a bottle of whiskey in the dressing room.
Whiskey in the dressing room. Just to like come off and then talk to people. And after this show, especially this incarnation of it, I think we see the people. I think everybody kind of has to like come down a little bit from what's just happened and sort of sit with it.
Yeah.
But it's nice to talk to people.
I was wondering about that.
To hear things that jumped out at them, to hear like, oh, I didn't. Sometimes it's like, I never thought about it that way before, but that's true. And it's helpful also to get a sense of like, where are you now that you've like spent this hour with us?
And it is tricky. You know, there's the conversation you have with people and it's like, good show, thank you. But, you know, when you really sit down with someone and talk about it, that's where it really gets interesting, where they're really talking about the ideas
too,
of the play.
Right?
Yeah.
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 What do you do, Scott?
I do the same thing. I try and... You know, meet
some
with friends
first
and talk. Well, I try and meet with friends and talk to them about, you know, what they experience. I mean, it's fringe time too, so a lot of times we're headed to other shows. Mm-hmm. I've already seen a bunch of shows, and today's a full day of shows. We're going to go see a rehearsal of Swamp Is On, the Pig Iron show, and we're really, you know, out there experiencing things.
Well, we're almost out of time here, and I know, Scott, you're up. You're going to be in Holden. This is an original production, George and Company at Fringe Arts in October.
Yeah, great team of people. Mm-hmm. I love working with those guys.
It's good stuff.
And for you, Jen, you're going to be in Antigone at the Wilma Theater.
Yes, I am.
Period.
Can you tell us more?
Yeah.
Share with the class?
No, it's pretty exciting. So... Blanca has invited a Greek director whose name is Theodoros Tertsopoulos to direct Antigone. And I go straight there after this.
Wow. Yeah.
There are 8 Philadelphia actors and 3, one guy from Italy, a person from Australia, and another Greek actor.
Wow.
And the assistant director is another Greek director actor. And we're making this piece. It's pretty different from Underground Railroad Game. It's pretty wild. He actually, the rehearsal room is closed.
Oh.
To everyone.
Oh, interesting.
Everyone.
Wow.
Except for us. So it's we start every day with 45 minutes to an hour of a physical warm-up exercise, and then get into like very physical, extremely like rigorous vocal work. It's going to be crazy.
On that note, a great pleasure to have both of you with us on Radio Times. Jennifer Kidwell, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Marty.
Thank you, Marty. You're
welcome. And Scott Shepherd, thank you very much as well. And again, their Underground Railroad Game, part of the Philadelphia Fringe Festival at Christ Church Neighborhood House through September 11th. There are only seats for the 9:30 show, as
special
I understand.
Added
it.
Show, special Friday
added
night.
Show on
Friday
September
night
11th. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Diana Allen is our intern this fall. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.